Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Invisible No More, Voices from Native America. Edited by Raymond Foxworth and Steve Dubb. Narrated by Jason Grazel. Forward. We are not invisible. I grew up in Ketchikan, Alaska. My neighborhood, Deermount, Park and Woodland, was not designated as an official Native village. This area south of Ketchikan Creek in the highly segregated town of Ketchikan differed in many ways from the traditional native village of Saxman, which was just south of town. But, for all intents and purposes, my neighborhood was a native village in that it was made up almost entirely of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian households from other native villages across Alaska, including Haidaberg, Metlakatla, Craig, Cake, and Klawok, where my family was from. Despite my cobbled-together native village of aspiring middle-class native households, much of the life in my neighborhood resembled that of other native villages. Smokehouses were found in most backyards. Families argued and held grudges about past slights and injustices. Fishing nets wintered in front yards. And the food traditions of hunting, fishing, and foraging carried on and supplemented the incomes and sustenance of almost every household. Aside from joining my brother at the beach or along the creek fishing, my favorite food activity growing up was berry picking. For me, it was the sweet reward of blueberries, huckleberries, and Southeast Alaska's favorite, salmon berries. But I was not the most accomplished berry picker. I mainly stayed on well-traveled streets and sidewalks and picked over paths and backyard patches. And my yield at the end of hours would often only be a few handfuls of fruit. And then one day, for some reason, I was up in the early morning, and I watched as a steady stream of native grandmas and aunties walked past my house with their berry-picking cans. These cans were 3-pound coffee containers with tethers made of discarded nylon stockings so they could be hung around their necks and free up both hands for picking. When these grandmas and aunties passed back by my house a few hours later, each and every one of them had 2 or 3 cans filled to the brim with salmon berries, enough for pies, multiple jars of jelly, and more. They had my attention. The next weekend, with a newly constructed berry-picking can around my neck, I followed these experienced ladies to a large thicket of salmonberry bushes along the creek. Among the brambles were years-old paths created by these grandmas and aunties, marking the way for others to follow. I share this story because, as Native people, we all look to our grandmas and aunties, our ancestors, and even our contemporaries, to point the way forward. We have a keen eye for knowledge and tradition and learning what can only come from experience. In a nutshell, or in this case a berry bucket, this is what this book is all about. It's about capturing deep knowledge held by Native peoples. Equally important, this book is about giving voice. Well, not actually giving voice, because voice is not mine to give. Nor does voice belong to the editors of this book, or to First Nations Development Institute, First Nations. People, including Native people, own their own voices. But sometimes those voices need amplification. And this book, Invisible No More, Voices from Native America, is an attempt to do just that. Make the invisible visible, amplifying the voices and knowledge of Native peoples and Native practitioners. I have spent a 30-year career at First Nations championing the idea that Native people matter and Native knowledge matters, as much as and not less than others. And for more than 4 decades now, First Nations has focused on asset-based development for, with, and by Indian country. We believe that this is incredibly important because the appropriated use of American Indian assets in the United States has created one of the world's wealthiest economies. This, of course, has had a negative impact on American Indian economies and communities. And it has exempted Native Americans from the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that are enjoyed by non-Native Americans. I am constantly amazed that 2 decades into a new century, we are still subjecting Native people to deliberate mistruths and falsehoods, rendering them invisible in American society. How is it that now, when information is more readily available than at any other time in history, we continue to be content in our ignorance of Native people and communities? Ambivalence occurs when individuals hold contradictory feelings or opinions about someone or some groups of people. Willful ignorance is simply the idea that, in the face of correct information, individuals tune out or dismiss truths and instead rely on pre-existing knowledge to nullify facts. People in Native America know that at all levels of American society, there is both ambivalence and willful ignorance when it comes to learning accurate information about Native people and communities. This book's authors hope to push back on the ambivalence and willful ignorance held by too many Americans, including many of the people who represent philanthropic institutions. The authors featured in this book represent some of Indian country's best thinkers. More importantly, each and every one of them are boots-on-the-ground practitioners who have dedicated most of their professional lives to the betterment of native communities. They have borne witness to and have been instrumental in the creation of incredibly creative solutions for not just native communities, but communities more broadly. And they've accomplished this in an environment in which private philanthropic funders have done their best to ignore, underfund, and, through their inaction, deem natives as not relevant. Although many of the authors in this collection toil in anonymity and are largely invisible outside of Indian country, they all have been and continue to be in it to win it for native communities and for making the lives of all native peoples better. Their knowledge, both new and old, is worth lifting up. Their voices are worth amplifying. The benefit of their sharing reaches beyond the native communities they serve, and they hold wisdom and offer solutions that benefit the world as a whole. The authors in this volume challenge those who sit in the boardrooms of philanthropic institutions to dismantle and reimagine the way they do business, and to adopt a way that centers the voices of communities normally excluded from philanthropy. Moreover, the voices in this book offer new perspectives on the economic and environmental crises we are grappling with today. Globally, inequality has grown inexorably, and wealth has been further concentrated in the pockets of the wealthy. Moreover, critical resources needed to sustain human life, like water, are being depleted, as are forests and other natural ecosystems. Native people have been at the forefront of reimagining capitalist models of development, honoring the value of our non-human relatives, including land, animals, water, etc. Native people in the United States and across the globe have known that Western development models are not sustainable. The voices in this book speak to these crises and offer critical solutions, and these are the voices that we must elevate and listen to if we are going to create a more equitable, sustainable, and just world for us all. The voices in this collection also offer a stark contrast to the predominant narratives about Native peoples that romanticize the Indians of the past but ignore Native peoples of the present and future. This collection of essays offers a new narrative, one grounded in Native history and Native values. It is one that gives Native people and Native practitioners visibility, and one that suggests a strong call to action. The crises that individual authors speak to in this book are not crises created by them or the communities they come from. They are crises created by a Western society that has viewed land and the environment as theirs to exploit, and wealth as theirs to hoard and use for power and the exploitation of workers and communities. Nonetheless, Native people continue to be optimistic and offer solutions to solve global problems. The question remains, will Americans listen? All of this is what we hope to provide in Invisible No More, Voices from Native America. It is yet another gift from Native America to America itself. I hope you cherish it with the same intent as that with which the gift was given. Michael Roberts, Longmont, Colorado. Introduction. Steve Dubb. They have assumed the names and gestures of their enemies, but have held on to their own secret soul, and in this there is a resistance and an overcoming, a long outwaiting. N. Scott Mamaday, Kiowa, Housemaid of Dawn. At its heart, this volume lifts up a wide range of vital stories from Native American leaders and organizations. There are many reasons that Raymond Foxworth and I decided to organize this collection. One reason appears right there in the title, Invisible No More. It is a long past time to end the invisibility of Native Americans and make Native American voices accessible to a broad popular audience. This book also is a product of a much broader movement among many people from within the 574 federally recognized indigenous nations, and the many more that remain unrecognized. In fact, the authors in this collection are among the leaders of a rising social, political, and cultural movement that has swept many Native communities. N. Scott Mamaday's writings, cited previously, form part of a broader cultural movement. The American Indian Movement, AIM, was founded in 1968, the same year that Mamaday's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel was published. A year later, AIM activists began a 19-month occupation of Alcatraz Island, garnering national attention. The official federal policy regarding Native Americans in the 1950s and 1960s was known as termination, and it meant exactly what it sounds like it meant. Federal government policy sought to terminate tribal nations and end Native sovereignty entirely. One tactic the federal government used was to offer free one-way tickets for Native Americans to move to relocation cities, like Portland, Oregon and Minneapolis, Minnesota. An estimated 100,000 people were moved in this way, This is one reason why 2/3 of Native Americans today live off the res in urban areas. Native American organizing such as AIM forced an end to federal termination policy, which was legislatively reversed in 1975 when Congress passed the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. Additional policy gains followed. It is worth reflecting on how recent some of these victories are. It was in 1978 that the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Indian Religious Freedom Act were passed. The former was designed to keep Native American families together and is currently facing a Supreme Court case challenge. The latter is a potent reminder that until 1978, Native Americans on reservations lacked the legal right to openly perform sacred ceremonies. Subsequent policy wins include the 1988 Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the 1994 Equity and Educational Land Grant Status Act. The latter established federal support for what is today a network of 35 tribal land-grant colleges with a combined student enrollment of 23,000. A recent study found that each dollar invested in a tribal college returns $5.20 in economic benefits to Native nations. As for gaming, a study published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives found that gaming generated $28 billion in revenue by 2013, up from $100 million in 1988. But cautions that the accumulated economic and social deficits on reservations far exceed gaming revenues. Indeed, as co-editor Raymond Foxworth has noted, not only is the distribution of gaming revenues among Native nations highly uneven, but the per capita gap in income between Native and non-Native Americans far exceeds by a factor of 10 or more any conceivably sustainable annual profit distribution scheme. In recent years, Native communities have also increasingly mobilized politically. On an international stage, this was evident at the internationally prominent pipeline protests at Standing Rock beginning in 2016. Mobilization also occurred at the ballot box, with Native voters playing a decisive role in swing states such as Arizona and Wisconsin in the 2020 presidential election. Native American voter turnout in 2020 reached record highs, and 6 Native Americans were elected to Congress, a record number and 3 times the Native congressional delegation that existed just 2 years earlier. Again, it is remarkable how recent all of this is. The first 2 indigenous women elected to Congress, Deb Holland, Laguna Pueblo, and Charisse Davids, Ho-Chunk, assumed their seats in January 2019. In 2021, Holland left Congress to become Secretary of the Interior, the first Native American cabinet official in over 2 centuries of U.S. history. Making the invisible visible. What is meant by invisibility? It is certainly no secret that North America, or Turtle Island, a common indigenous name for the continent, particularly among the Algonquin and Iroquois nations, was settled by indigenous peoples many millennia before European settlers arrived. But mainstream, read white, U.S. society has often refused to see this. Often, Native Americans have been treated as vestiges of the past, not living people today. And even when looking at the past, the historical account is regularly distorted. The violence of genocide, including the seizure of an estimated 1.5 billion acres, over 2.3 million square miles, of land and forcible relocation of people onto reservations is downplayed, if not denied altogether. The so-called Indian boarding schools, which explicitly sought to separate Native children not just from their parents but their culture, "Kill the Indian, save the man," was the refrain of Colonel Richard Henry Pratt, founder of one of the most famous of these schools in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, are also typically ignored. Instead, often what passes for history are warmed-over myths, such as Thanksgiving narratives that offer, as Lower Brule Sioux member Jordan Daniel kindly puts it, a very romanticized, whitewashed education, or Hollywood westerns that have regularly employed the dual stereotype of the noble Indian and the bloodthirsty savage. Meanwhile, millions of Native Americans today often remain unacknowledged. As a social studies teacher said to an Education Week reporter in a segment broadcast by PBS NewsHour a few years ago, "When you tell students that Native people are still here in America, they're like, oh, we didn't know that." Challenging invisibility in philanthropy. This invisibility has major consequences throughout U.S. society. This volume does not purport to cover all aspects of this, but it does make a valuable contribution in showing how Native nonprofit institutions and Native nonprofit leaders are actively challenging that invisibility in the philanthropic world. Nationally, in the United States in 2021, total philanthropic giving totaled $484.85 billion. In terms of assets, that year foundation assets exceeded $1.3 trillion. There are, in short, considerable resources that could make a significant difference if philanthropy adequately resourced the obvious leadership emerging from Native communities. Unfortunately, far too many in the philanthropic world have failed to step up for Native communities. For example, a 2020 study produced by Native Americans in Philanthropy and Candid, a leading nonprofit sector research firm, noted that while 2.9% of Americans are indigenous, between 2002 and 2016, only 0.4% of foundation grant dollars served Native Americans. A more recent survey conducted in the spring of 2021 by the Center for Effective Philanthropy, CEP, found that, even though Native communities experienced greater levels of economic stress and the highest rates of infection and death from the COVID-19 pandemic, only 11% of 256 surveyed foundations made significant funding commitments during 2020 and 2021 to Native-serving nonprofits. The CEP research team correspondingly titled the report that resulted from their survey, Overlooked. Moreover, if one looks at funding for not just Native-serving but also Native-led organizations, then the level of philanthropic support is even more limited. For instance, a 2018 report from First Nations Development Institute that examined grant-making from 2006 to 2014 found that the majority of grant dollars awarded annually in support of Native American causes are awarded to non-Native-controlled nonprofit organizations. Even when foundations do make grants, stereotypes often color what is and is not funded. One Native leader cited in the CEP report noted that a foundation program officer had told their group that they couldn't fund us because the participants in our program were successful emerging leaders. We interpreted that as, they just want to fund drunk, starving Indians on the reservation or on Skid Row in the city. They're not interested in what Native American leaders can contribute to the rest of society. Such examples are disturbingly common. As one contributor, Tricia Mokino, Pueblo of Cochiti, notes in this volume, we often feel ashamed and traumatized for thinking that our community goals to heal and thrive on our own terms do not match nicely with the broader goals of philanthropy, or people in philanthropy. Hidden in plain sight. As the late baseball great Yogi Berra famously said, you can observe a lot by watching. Many in philanthropy and elsewhere may not be watching, but if they were to do so, they would observe a wide range of Native American solutions that carry considerable relevance not just for addressing local needs, but also global challenges. This speaks to one more critical motive behind the creation of this volume, which is to illustrate how Native individuals and organizations are leading dynamic movements for social, economic, and environmental justice. Simply put, in a world facing mounting crises around economic inequality, the global climate emergency, and environmental degradation, many of the most innovative solutions to these challenges are being developed in indigenous communities. Often these solutions derive from indigenous value systems, cultural traditions, and an ethic of stewardship. But these solutions and the creativity that lies behind them are also in large part the product of marginalization. While innovation is often depicted as emanating from high-tech firms, when it comes to far-reaching social change, more often than not, innovation comes from people who have a lesser stake in the status quo and who are therefore less constrained by present-day myths. As Tariq Halal, a British-born social entrepreneur working in Africa, observes, constraints drive innovation. Faced with the challenges of exclusion, people invent. The solutions that they create not only present solutions to their own problems, but often have far wider applications. As will be seen in the essays that follow, the authors in this volume are not academics. They are not just writing about solutions. They are instead writing about solutions that they themselves are implementing in their own communities. This collection provides a window into the rich world of cultural, social, environmental, and economic innovation that is spreading across Native America. How this collection was assembled. This collection results from a partnership that developed between First Nations Development Institute, First Nations, where Raymond was serving as vice president, and Nonprofit Quarterly, NPQ, where I work as a senior editor. When we first connected, we discussed how NPQ, which hosts social justice conversations, might partner with First Nations to run a series of articles on the relationship between Indian country and philanthropy. At first, the idea was to ask philanthropic leaders to write about how their foundations were supporting grant-making in Indian country and highlight what others could learn from their experiences. But out of our conversations emerged a different approach. Why not provide a forum for Native leaders to speak directly to philanthropy? Of the authors in this volume, mine is the sole settler voice, and I grew up with the same myths that I write about here. For example, when I was 6 and 7, I participated in a YMCA-sponsored program known as Indian Guides that clumsily appropriated Native American culture and has, fortunately, been discontinued. My first exposure to working in Indian country involved my participation in a project known as the Learning Action Lab for Community Wealth Building. This project, which I worked in between 2013 and 2016, was with the Democracy Collaborative, a former employer of mine. Our team sought to help Native communities to use employee ownership and social enterprise strategies to build and retain community wealth. Funded by the Northwest Area Foundation, we worked with two urban Native groups in Portland, Oregon and Minneapolis, Minnesota, and three reservation-based groups. In the process, I saw the cultural rebuilding that was occurring in real time, as many Native leaders, who were often the first in their generation to go to college, were building new worlds by combining contemporary practices with restored indigenous cultural traditions. In short, my personal experience persuaded me that an approach that offered stories directly from Indian country would generate stories worth reading and would resonate with NPQ's readership. As it happens, the first series was so well received that First Nations and NPQ decided to co-produce three more series over the next 2 years, each tackling a different theme, which here are organized as the sections of this book. The process was as follows. First, we would agree upon a common theme. Then, First Nations, mostly Raymond, but sometimes his colleague, Ade Romero Briones, identified the authors and topics and would help individual authors or author teams develop their stories. Then, after First Nations had completed its review, NPQ, often me, but sometimes my colleague, Cassandra Halicher, would work with the authors to edit and refine the articles for publication. By early 2022, Raymond and I realized that the richness of the content merited the broader audience that this volume could attract. In putting together this collection, however, we asked authors to update and revise their contributions into the chapters that exist here. We have also, where appropriate, added new voices that complement these contributions. And in section introductions, we have added text to connect the articles with each other and the broader conversation. Organization of the work. We have organized the book into four sections. The first section, Indigenous Perspectives on Philanthropy, offers a series of seven contributions organized into four chapters that speak to the central problem of invisibility, highlight the importance of language recovery to cultural rebuilding, identify how philanthropy has often, whether intentionally or not, undermined Native community building, and offer principles for building more trust-based, reciprocal relationships. The next section, Protecting the Environment, focuses on Native American environmental preservation efforts in a variety of locations. In this section, our authors write about indigenous management techniques for caring for forests by using controlled fires, the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, including analysis of the interconnection between environmental and gender justice, the effort to restore historical Hawaiian fishery management practices, Hopi attempts to maintain desert agriculture amid climate change, and a reconceptualization of the food system rooted in Cochiti Pueblo practices of land stewardship. The third section, Indigenous Perspectives on Environmental Justice, builds on the second section, but with a more explicit focus on climate justice and the often complicated relationship between the formal, often white-dominated, environmental movement and indigenous groups. From Hawaii to Alaska to an island in Louisiana in which the Choctaw community has seen 98% of their island home disappear due to rising sea levels, the writers in this section offer critical insights on the connections among vision, culture, policy, and environmental justice. In the final section of the book, Building Native Economies Toward an Indigenous Economics, the authors recast and redefine what is meant by economy. The root words of economy, eco and nomos, mean management of home, eco being the Greek root for home and nomos the Greek root for management. The authors here part from this broad notion of economy and offer their visions for an indigenous economy that is rooted in justice that decolonizes Native communities and creates self-sustaining indigenous economies. The themes of the chapters in this section range from tackling the issue of financing development on trust lands, to supporting Native business ownership, to developing Native community finance, to restructuring entire lending models and even the entire economy to place notions of multi-generational thinking and regeneration at the center. Let the conversation begin. In short, this book is animated by the belief that narratives rooted in indigenous experience have much to contribute to a recalibration of the economy, the environment, and human relationships, both for indigenous communities and beyond. We hope this collection speaks both to Native and non-Native audiences. It is, of course, impossible to reflect the true diversity of over 500 different indigenous nations, but we hope that members of Native communities feel that they are seen in this volume. And we hope that non-Native audiences observe a lot by watching. A few final notes. In this book, we seek to challenge narratives about Native Americans that have been central to dehumanizing them. We hope that after listening to this collection, that the energy and vital role played by Native leaders and organizations in today's social change movements, especially in the fields of environmental and economic justice, is obvious. And we hope that the publication of this volume is not a one-off, but instead will spark far greater interest in new platforms for Native communities, so many of whom are offering leading-edge thinking for how to build a sustainable world. We also hope that this book is widely studied not just by students of Native America, but policymakers and philanthropists as well. We know that tensions and hostility over land and natural resources have shaped relationships between the federal government and Native nations across the continent. We hope that the authors in this collection inspire a deepening conversation of what decolonization means and what decolonization requires. The reciprocal practices lifted up by many of the authors really do offer some paths forward, if the wisdom of the authors is heeded. Lastly, this book also highlights indigenous solutions that are key to solving some of the current global crises around inequality, climate change, and environmental degradation. Beyond the individual offerings of the authors, the call here is to move beyond the walls that separate culture, economy, and environment, as if these were distinct, disconnected spheres. Fundamentally, the call for stewardship, the call for righting the wrongs of colonization and for supporting indigenous sovereignty, and the call for sustainable environmental practices are really calls to all audiences to recognize that interconnected nature of the world we live in and to act accordingly. Part 1. Indigenous Perspectives on Philanthropy. The first section of this book begins with the voices and perspectives of Native community leaders who are challenging the horrible misperceptions and stereotypes that many in philanthropy have about Native people and communities. These leaders are directly challenging philanthropic practices that both intentionally and unintentionally exclude Native people from the grant portfolios of many, indeed most, philanthropic institutions in this country. This exclusion both results from Native invisibility and reinforces it. And if one looks more closely, it quickly becomes apparent that this philanthropic inaction results from inattention to the widespread community-based work that is taking place today in Native American communities. The chapters are all written by Native nonprofit leaders who are actively working to beat back the oppressive powers of formalized philanthropy and are crafting new practices, frameworks, and values to transform philanthropy. Raymond Foxworth, Navajo, kicks off this section with a discussion of how philanthropy is a system rooted in settler colonialism built on the theft of Native lands and assets. In its practices, philanthropy often perpetuates colonial values, ideologies, and practices that seek to erase and exclude Native people today. He calls on philanthropy to learn from Native views of philanthropy to improve philanthropy for future generations. In Chapter 2, Valerie Segrest, Muckleshoot, and Lisa Wilson, Muckleshoot, discuss how deficit-based approaches permeate philanthropic practices and call on philanthropy to adopt asset-based approaches to honor the rich traditional knowledge that tribal nations rely on to nurture their holistic approaches to community challenges. Brooke Moseyaman, Ojibwe, also looks at the history of Native resilience to talk about the important role of language and cultural revitalization. Drawing on her experiences with the Wadukadauding Ojibwe Language Institute, she highlights how language and culture are fundamental to advancing other Native community goals, including those around food sovereignty, land protection, and more. In Chapter 3, Sarah Echohawk, Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, and Tricia Mokino, Pueblo Villages of Cochiti, Okeawinge, and Kiwa, both discuss specific harmful philanthropic practices. Echohawk weighs into discussions on capacity building occurring in the philanthropic section by acknowledging that building organizational capacity, finances, leadership, programs, and infrastructure, is important for the Native nonprofit sector. But the methods of philanthropy, including imposing outside models on Native American community organizations and focusing on capacity, or lack of, provide far too easy excuses for philanthropy not to invest in valuable and transformative Native community work. Mokino, in her powerful contribution, discusses her experiences in fundraising during the formative years of the Karis Children's Learning Center. She discusses some of the trauma she experiences in fundraising and notes that for foundations to truly share power, a common theme in the sector today, They must start with sharing true.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?